Marriage of Deceit is the book. 30 years in the making. Something that my mom wrote during her, I'd say, challenging marriage to my father. And she kind of sat on it. And so I guess the first question is, why now?
Why now? Well, I'm at the time of my life where you say, well, is it almost over? We all think of that when we're over 70. And I just had to let other women know, especially. There's so many people living unhappy and abused. And with everything coming down this year about everybody being molested, I thought, this is the perfect time. So with my daughter's help and my son, it finally come about. And I'm really, really happy it has. I'm getting some good feedback, Keith.
Already. And, you know, the book hasn't even been officially released yet. This weekend, if you guys are interested, go to marriageofdeceit.com. And there's an open house. You get to meet my mom, do a meet and greet, for especially for the early supporters of the GoFundMe campaign that helps support getting this book published, because it's 100% independent. My mom and my sister did it all on their own, working with a company called Tellwell. And, you know, we'll get your experience on that in a little bit. But yeah, just crowdsourced it for pre-orders of the book. And with a little bit of luck as well, because from what I remember, you also won a bit of money in the bingo that helped pay for that as well. Yeah.
Yes, yes. That was a nice surprise.
So, you know, that helped pay for the editing, the publishing, the printing, the cover design, all that stuff that goes into the making of a book. And yeah, so there's an open house this weekend. Check it out if you want to get a copy of the book. On this podcast, we're going to essentially break down the entire book. This is just going to be an intro episode of like why you decided to do this book, why now, this kind of stuff. And then in the forthcoming episodes, we're going to actually break down the chapters one by one with the author, my mom, and just get her thoughts on some of the stuff, if I have any questions. Because this is not only really a breakdown of the book itself, but what's cool about this podcast for me is I was the quote-unquote, I wouldn't say mistake, the last minute surprise, I guess.
Happy surprise. Kept me young.
And, you know, my mom left my father when I was 3, and I didn't know the whole story about all the, like, conniving, the abuse. Throughout my life, I've heard bits and pieces at family get-togethers, which it seems to be every time we get together for Christmas, Mom. You know, bits and pieces of whatever childhood come up. And as we're going to read the book together, it's kind of a bit of self-discovery too. So I'm really excited to do this with you. I want to break down the beginning. When did you first start writing this?
Well, at one point, Keith, when you were very young, the gun was cocked and put to my head.
A shotgun?
A .38. And he cocked the gun to my head.
Hold on. Whoa. Okay. Because you got to give me some pretext to this.
Yes.
You can't just say, guy walks in with a gun. Like, what?
What happened?
What happened?
My younger daughter was having some fight with a little girlfriend. She chased her up our front stairs. And my daughter was screaming. And Keith was only 3. Of course, it frightened a child to hear all his sister screaming and the girl chasing her and yelling. So he started to scream bloody murder. So I went to cuddle him and told him everything was okay and everything quiet down. But he didn't quiet down.
He isn't me.
This is
what I love about it.
Yes, we don't go into detail because to me, I see it, but he doesn't see it. He doesn't know it. He was only 3.
Yeah.
Then his father was in the house, Ken. And he grabbed him off me, threw him on the floor, and kept kicking him in the ribs. And I went ballistic, terrified of this man, but I forgot the fear. I had to protect my child. I grabbed him off of him and started slapping and punching him in the face. So right away, this man went for his gun. He controlled our house at that point with
guns. So for him, we're obviously going to get into the more detail of like the other stuff.
Yes.
With you know, yes, preceding
episodes.
Yes,
that's what sort of got me into the shelter. And then
No, but hold on. I just want to go back.
Yes.
So for him, the controlling was, I guess, verbal. And then if that didn't work, he'd go physical. And then if that didn't work, he'd use a weapon?
That's right.
Okay. But the ultimate thing was that he had to be in control at all times.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Okay. So he
would control you by words, and then he would break furniture and blame you on causing him to do it.
Right.
Then through time, through years, he started controlling the house with his guns.
Okay. We'll bring you back. I was a hysterical. He was kicking me to protect your child, starting attacking him.
That's
right. To protect me.
That's right.
That's when he went for the gun?
That's right. I had the child in my arms at the time, and he went for the gun.
And then what happened?
Then he pointed it to my head and cocked it and said to give him the child. At that point, what do you do?
What do you do?
Don't give him the child. You know you're going to get that bullet in the head. I thought. Who knows? Who knows? Up until today.
Mom, I don't understand how you can talk about this story with a clear, like, without, it doesn't even sound like you're emotionally compromised by it. Has it been because it's so long?
Not because, you see, talk for me it worked as therapy.
Okay.
I mean, I went into cleaning jobs and I told so many people about it, and it's been a repeat of telling the same story year after year
after
year.
So that it gets easier, I guess?
Somehow, yes. Not easier, but not as harsh.
It's easier to cope with?
Not as shocking to me.
Okay. So less shocking.
Right.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay.
That's how. But it was talking about it that did the therapy.
That helped you. Because you never did therapy, right?
Never. I never had to. I think I did my own. You talked to a psychiatrist. I was talking to everybody.
You just used everybody.
And that worked.
To listen.
It worked.
It helped you.
I never got over the fear of him. Never. You never forget. You can forgive.
Couldn't
but
even
you can
imagine.
Never forget. You, these things will always stay in your mind and your heart. And
yeah.
You asked me, Keith, about writing the book. I never thought about writing the book until I got into the shelter and the nun there was nuns running the shelter.
So just take you back 2 seconds. The altercation happened. He pointed the gun at you. He said, give me the child. You said no?
That's right. Then he cocked the gun.
To your head?
To my head. To my brain, right near my ear, between my ear and the top of my head.
Do you think he would have done it?
I don't know.
Or do you think he was
up
just trying
today,
to?
Up until today, I was shaking. I don't know. I mean, through the years after, he claimed he never did it, even in court. He thinks that he was telling everybody
it
was crazy.
Was it loaded?
But he fooled himself.
Was the gun
yes,
loaded?
Yes, yes. He always kept them loaded. I used to see him clean those bullets.
Because, I mean, imagine, see if he just slipped.
I know.
Fuck.
I believe in God and angels, and somebody saved me there. I believe somebody, something. I don't know when.
He pulls the gun. He cocks it to your head. Then what does he say?
Give me the kid. And he tells me to get the fuck, excuse my language, out of my house. This was my house.
Out of his house.
My lease. My everything.
But he wanted to get the fuck out of your house.
He told me to get out of his house. My daughter had disappeared. I don't know where she went. And I had a friend across the street. And I ran across the street and asked her for help.
Yeah.
And that's when it all started. Going to the shelter, calling the police.
And then in the shelter.
In that shelter, the nun suggested that I write a book. Because I was telling her story. I don't know if she believed me or what. She says, you've got to help other women. You can't keep this a secret. You got to let the world know.
And what year was this?
Okay, Keith.
84?
You were going on 4, so.
85.
Yes.
Wow. 85 to 2018.
Yeah.
33 years.
Yeah. I made a lot of notes through the years.
So was it a note? So walk me through the process. Was it sporadic? Like you would write a couple chapters, a couple years later you'd think of something? Or was it like, did you write the whole thing all in one shot? Like
no.
How did that work?
No.
Was it just like you're at home and you're like, I'm starting?
Yeah.
Like what was the trigger?
I think after going to Noella's house, I went there a
Noella's
lot.
Noella's your longtime friend.
Yeah, and at first she didn't know what was going on. She used to got me to smoke up, and I'm not a drug addict. Nothing to do with drugs.
Was to calm you down? Because yes. I mean, I couldn't even imagine the anxiety.
The only reason why I started to tell her what was otherwise, I was warned by him if I ever told anything, or he would blow my brains out. So it's always stayed with me. I never told anybody what was going on about the guns or nothing.
So, you never told your family at all about the guns?
No.
Ever?
They knew we had guns.
But like you never told them about the physical abuse, the mental abuse?
Never.
He had you that controlled.
That's right.
That you wouldn't tell your family, your friend,
anything. That's right. Even on Valium at one point. He had me on Valium.
So that you would be controlled.
That's right. And I was told time after time, the only reason you're alive is because I'm feeding you, or because I'm dressing you. He made me feel like I was a thing, not even a person.
An object, yeah.
Yeah, and he owned it and he controlled. This was my total life with him. You would never think that a person could control somebody that way. But he did.
Wow. He did. Yeah. Okay. You meet Noella. Noella gets you to open up. The first time, is this the first time you ever opened up to anybody about it?
The first time.
And how did it feel to finally get that out?
Relief like you wouldn't believe. And I hung on to her like she was my salvation. She used to say to me, you gotta leave him. You can't live like that. And I used to say to her, no, Noella, he'll kill me if I leave him. He'll find me anywhere and kill me.
You truly believe that?
And I did. And she said, don't you realize when you're with him, you're dead? You right now, you are dead. You're not a person. And staying there, he can even, people lose it. He could blow you, and never mind you, all your kids away. You've got to go. She prepared me, I think. And then that incident happened with Wendy's girlfriend. Okay. And she was preparing me to leave him. She was trying to help me get up the confidence, the nerve, which I didn't have. So I smoked up with her, drank, and she gave me that confidence. I relaxed because I was always uptight. Always. I went down 110 pounds. My regular weight should have been.
How tall are you?
Okay, I was 5'7 at the time. I shrunk a bit through the years.
Yeah.
I was only 110. I was a bone.
So it was just constant years of anxiety, being tense.
Existing, period. Not even living.
Wow. How many years existing?
Well, you might say 25 years, you might say. Yeah. But he got worse the past, you might say, 10 years. Or, you know, he got worse and worse.
Worse in the sense that mentally worse?
That's the way I look at it now, yes.
Okay.
But there was so much going on, it was like a puzzle to me. I never had proof. He was one of the best cons in Canada. A lieutenant told me in LaSalle he was the best. So
He used his talents. He was talented, but he used it for the wrong
goodness.
Reasons.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
All right. So let's go quickly back to when you started to write.
Yes.
So it was after Noella, and how did it feel like to start getting it out, all these stories that you were telling people, to actually put it from pen to paper?
It felt good. Sometimes I was in the bathtub, just taking a bath, and things would come back to me, and I'd get out of the bath, hurry up, and start writing all these notes. It wasn't written as a story right away. I made a lot of notes. Okay. And later
through
the years, I made the book out of it.
Okay, so was it like the first 5 years of just writing down, like, say if you had a memory of something happening with Wayne or something happening with Wendy, then you just write a bunch of notes on it, and then you collected these notes over the years and made the book?
And sometime I'd write paragraphs. I'd write maybe 10 pages, and then I'd let it go maybe for 5-6 years. That's the way it was
written. Just whenever you felt inspired for something.
Yeah, that's the only time. Yeah.
Okay, so how long were you doing these notes? And then you decided you had enough content to actually then take that and rewrite it and make a book. Like, walk me through that process.
Well, that came much later. It came much later because things improved in my life when he wasn't in my life. I remember. Yeah. I went and got a bunch of loose leaf papers. It was all done by hand. I don't type. I never did like typing.
Yeah.
And it was all done by hand. I went and got a bunch of pencils and pencil sharpeners and erasers. Yeah, I remember faintly. I started to write. And I felt good. I felt good that I was going to... I had hopes of writing the book in a month, 6 months, but...
Well, it was just because you, I mean, you know, we don't have any family history of creatives, really, so...
But I was good in composition in school always, so I thought maybe I got something here. But then what discouraged me is the price of having it edited and printed. I said,
back in the 90s, I mean, my God, forget it. You have to be a major author.
Yes, I had to let it go, and it discouraged me. At times.
Well, I mean, and now's a great time to be alive, to be a creator. I know this, in fact, because, you know, doing podcasting for about 5-6 years now, you know, I was able to share my weight loss journey very recently. And, you know, I'm not a radio personality. I'm just a guy, just a regular guy, you know, and I'm able to put my story out there. And now, you know, being an independent author, you had this thing you were sitting on for 30 years.
Yes.
And with, you know, and not that it was cheap, it was still a little expensive to get it done, but compared to 10, 20 years ago when you'd have to go to a major publisher.
Oh, yes.
I mean, now it allows everybody to just
They were asking me $1,000 just to read it. Never mind edit it. Just to read it. And it wasn't to get it back. I didn't like that. At all.
Well, that's it. But I mean, now's the great time to do it. So now, you know, we have the book, you had the book in your hands. And so I guess the next question is, what does it feel like to be a first-time author at 78 years old?
It feels fantastic. It really does. When my daughter brought the book to the house, she picked them all up. And I said, Wendy, this is better than gold to me. And I cried because... it was a lot. And now I'm still feeling sad because my whole life, everybody knows my past. And I just hope it helps a lot of women because I never thought there was a way out ever, ever until Noella came along, the shelter. And now the book, I think there is a way out for so many women. We don't have to live in misery and hell. And I bet you it's not only women. I'm sure there's men out there too. I'm sure. And the women are controlling them, and we don't have to put up with this at all.
And I think your story is going to help.
And one small thing I want you, Keith, you said you didn't help much. You have, and your friends have been so generous with their donations and this cause.
Yeah.
I want to thank them all now, and you too. You too. And even for this podcast, I thank you very much.
And it's a great story to tell, not only for... especially women who are dealing with physical and mental abuse. This might help them maybe relate, you know, convince, show them that they're not alone.
Yes.
Maybe inspire them to make a change in their life. But also, you know, there's also another part of, like, some of these stories that we're going to go through are absolutely insane. When you said, you know, he was the best con artist in Canada and all this stuff.
Yes.
Like, this guy... I remember one of my early childhood memories, because I didn't spend a lot of time with him, obviously. But I remember being in a mall with him, and we went to a clothing store. And not really never knowing what he did, because he didn't work, right? But I didn't really know, like, if he had a profession or whatever. You know, And so he goes to the clothing store, and he overhears one of the managers talking about... shoplifting thing that just happened. And so he then proceeds to pull out a badge, told the manager that he was an undercover policeman, started taking down all this information, left the store, and then was not mentioned again. Like, it didn't happen. Like, I just witnessed my father pull out a badge, pretend to be a police officer, and then take a report. Like, that was normal. And I remember that being the first time, like, something doesn't add up. So that doesn't make any sense. But he was so believable that even I didn't even question it.
No, he believed his own lies. He did at one point.
And then, you know, the next day or something, it just clicking, like, did my dad just pull a badge on the, like, pretend he was a cop? You guys are going to hear the craziest shit. And I'm going to learn this stuff as I go along because, again, bits and pieces for me. One thing I want to talk about, too, is you decided to take some of the proceeds and give it to local shelters.
Yes.
Now, why is that important for you?
Because I was in one, well, actually, for 3.5 months. Because of all the fraud papers he was handing into the court, they all had to be checked out. We couldn't get him out of the house because at that time I was married to him. I had remarried him and at one point. So the nuns, the people in the shelter were so helpful. And I found out recently that there's so many shelters here in Montreal, which I didn't even know existed, that are lacking of funds, that are overcrowded. And I know...
This is of women who have been abused?
Yes, mainly women.
They have no other option.
No,
because
they have nowhere to go.
Because these men, I guess like my father, stalk and try to find them,
and
right?
Some are from other countries and they don't even have any relatives here, Keith. So where are they going to go?
They have no other option.
They have nowhere to go. They go back to their own country. They'd probably be caught and shot anyway. So it's horrible. Horrible. So this is why we're going to donate a percentage of our funds. And we're looking now for more than one, a couple. The one I was in turned into a man shelter. It's totally different.
Okay.
So we're going to find them and we're going to be donating. And I think it's the right thing for me to do. And everybody feels good about it. And that's what I want to do.
Yeah. In a year's time, what do you hope this book accomplishes?
I hope I get good feedback from some of the women and how I've helped them, and that'll just make my day. And
I mean, I've seen, you know, coming from an outside perspective, I think this whole project and finally getting the book finished, edited, sent to this third-party Tellwell, and going from that concept to the cover design to the actual physical book, I see how you're... you've changed. You know, over the last year, I find that you maybe lacked a bit of purpose.
I have.
And, you know, like every time I'd call you, you'd be talking about your crossword puzzles and what was on TV. And a little part of me, you know, kind of hurt inside because I knew that you're always a person that's very proud of work or what you did. You know, you cleaned houses for so many years, but you always gave 100%, even whatever you did. And you're very proud of your work. And I find that ever since you lost that work, you kind of lost that drive, that.
Well, everybody likes to feel good about what they do.
Yeah.
And knowing they've helped people somewhere along the line. And I'm on the road to helping people. And that's a good feeling.
And I see the spark in you now.
Yes.
And it's been a long time. So I'm really, if nothing financially, or, you know, maybe this book doesn't do the greatest, because we never know how the reception's going to be. But I think just the completion of this book and having this project finally fulfilled and in your hands and done, I think it was worth the whole thing.
Oh, so, yeah.
And everything is like a bonus now.
Yes. Yeah, it's been therapy and I want to help people. And it's just,
yeah,
it's a good feeling.
Now that it's out, now you can actually go and help people. So
yeah.
Open house is going to be this weekend. If not, you go to marriageofdeceit.com. And very, very soon, we're going to have an ebook available as well on all the major platforms, if that's what you prefer. If you want a physical book, message my sister Wendy in the Facebook chat. It's very old school. It's not a big publishing company. It's my sister that literally delivers you the book. So if you're in the local area, you can meet my mom this weekend, or you can get your book delivered by my sister who helped get that book going. We don't have an email or anything yet, but just go for marriageofdeceit.com for now. As of the next episode, we'll have, an audio feed for subscribing to this podcast, for getting in touch with my mom too. If you have any questions regarding the book and the chapters we break down, if there's anything that you were more curious about, ask us and we'll actually bring it up with the author, my mom, on the podcast. So I guess that's it, Mom. Thank you very much for being on this week.
Thank you, and God bless everybody out there.
And next week, we'll start with Chapter 1.